Good evening, you guys. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Along with John, KC2 WGB, John and Dick, attempt to organize this thing called the TechNet, a very enthusiastic group of guys that meet most Sunday evenings to teach each other ham radio, to figure out how all of this hardware works. There's an awful lot of stuff. I'll give you a more abbreviated message in the beginning. You guys know what I'm usually going to say. The main thing that the people who gather at the TechNet have in common is curiosity. They want to know how this stuff works. And that's a good thing, because it is my opinion that the majority of progress that mankind makes because somebody has curiosity in that particular area. Without it, not much changes. A person signs into the TechNet by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After the sign-in, we make a sincere effort during the first hour to answer everyone's question that signed in, at least briefly during the first hour. At the end of that first hour, John goes to Mel's Corner, the mailbag, where people who don't yet have their ham license have questions that they ask us, and hopefully they get an answer, either on the air or John writes to them. In general, the TechNet is a live, word-of-mouth conversation between us and the brain power that exists in the tri-state area. Lots of smart guys exist in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, which this repeater covers quite a bit of. And as such, hopefully when a subject is being discussed, somebody in one of those areas has knowledge that he can bring forth and help us all out. So that's the first hour of questions plus the mailbag, two or three questions that John handles. Then if NASA has been doing something interesting, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, gives us a review of that. After that, we go into the deeper subjects. Wesley has presented to us tonight some interesting questions with reference to waveguide and how it really works. Waveguide, plasma, standing wave ratio, and those subjects are always of interest because we amateurs know standing wave ratio is there. Not many of us feel a warm, fuzzy feeling knowing exactly what it is, how to conquer it, how much of it is bad. You'd be amazed how many times there are antennas that work very well with a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. There are other circumstances where your transmitter will give you quite a bit of grief if the standing wave ratio is higher than 1.5. So what's bad, 1.5 or 20-to-1? And the answer is, it depends. It varies. Just explaining that can keep people busy for a long time. A typical sign-in might sound like this, KC2, W-I-E, and Eric. But do we have question checking? Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
N2EO, Rich and yes.
Yes.
Okay, that was a triple. I heard Rich first. I heard RYY second. Who is the third person?
J3N. Who's the general question?
Yeah, I know we've got Wes. There is a person that I'm hearing on the input, but he's not coming through the machine. I think he doesn't have his 136.5 PL turned on. One of the things that's confusing with this machine is that some people have a scanner by which they can scan the PL tones, and they don't quite realize that this particular machine has a 141 hertz PL tone on the output, but the input requires a 136.5 hertz PL tone. 4Z PL must be present on the input for you to come through the machine. I think in the past, let me do a quick test here. Okay, that doesn't check. I just turned off my PL tone. In the past, it looks like today is one of those days in which you don't need the PL on the input. Now, who was that other person checking in? Give me a call letters right now. Okay, and one last call. So far, we've got Rich, Joe, and Wes. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
G2T, Joe.
Okay, G2T, Joe. Oh, we got you. Okay. Sometimes he comes in from southern parts, but today, I bet you he's local. Alrighty, more than enough to get going. Let's see what's going on there in Whitestone. Rich, N2EO. The person who keeps jingles happy. What's going on in your neighborhood, Rich? K2LIW.
putting up batteries 6 meter kilowatt, and we had discussed in the past, I'm thinking about taking another SP220 in amp, ripping it apart, it makes a good platform for amplifiers for other bands, in this case 2 meters. What I want to do is rip out the 3500Z, use the power supply, control circuitry, the meter circuitry, and put a sub chassis in there with a strip line and a 3CX-D100, which is a triode, for 2 meters, 2 meter sideband. I had visited this once before with you, Dick, but I wanted to just touch base on this again because I'll be working on this probably in the fall, so I want to try and get some information. On strip line output, in particular 2 meters, does a strip line have to be a particular length, like an eighth wave, a quarter wave? Let me let it reset. I've seen strip line outputs for 2 meters where they take a blocking cap off the plate of the tube, so the tube is sitting in high RF potential, so many inches long the strip line goes to the ground, and they've got usually a pickup loop in series with a capacitor coupled to the output. Now, I know in your RIW kilowatt, the 432, you use the flapper capacitor. That, I would imagine, is capacitively coupled, where like a coupling loop in series with a capacitor would be an inductive coupler. That's one thing I'm trying to figure out. And the strip line, would it have to be an eighth wave long? Could it be, what I'm getting at is, if the tube is going to be a very high impedance, and if it was a quarter wave long, it would be 0 degrees to 90 degrees. I think you see what I'm getting at. It's hard to put into words, but I think you know what I'm getting at, Dick. I'm trying to figure the length of the strip line, and if you tap it down, you're going to have a high impedance. If the plate, you're going to have 0 ohms. If the far end, where do you tap it to get the 50 ohm impedance point? You see what I'm getting at, Dick? K2RIW, Tech Jet, Limebox. Maybe I'm not making myself clear. M2EF.
You made yourself very clear, Rich. What you're requesting is a small manual for design practices of strip line amplifiers for the final plate circuit of a high power amplifier. I'm pretty sure you're not going to get the whole answer tonight. We're going to give you portions of the answer. You'll be asking more questions either later on tonight or in future weeks. But strip line is an extremely high efficiency, easy to reproduce method of making a VHF, UHF plate resonator circuit. I think it's very difficult for you to come up with a circuit that's higher in performance or easier to build, and both of those combined, other than strip line. Anybody on 6 meters and above who's not using, well, 2 meters and above for sure, who's not using strip line is probably denying himself a lot of capability simply because he doesn't have the knowledge. Now, the strip line plate circuit will be resonated at your operating frequency. That's a given. Your final tank circuit of any transmitter must be brought into resonance in order to have a reasonable power output, reasonable frequency selectivity, so you're not transmitting second and third harmonics. You will resonate the plate circuit. Now, the strip line itself, if the strip line was operating all by itself as a cavity-tuned filter element, and if one end of it was grounded, which means you're going to be making it a quarter-wave long resonator, for you to design a piece of strip line that's a quarter-wavelength long, grounded at one end, and then maybe with a very small tuning capacitor at the high impedance end, that's relatively easy. There's a catch. Although the plate circuit of the tube has a very high resistive component of impedance, quite often numbers like 1,000, 1,500, maybe even 2,000 ohms, depending on what tube and what voltage you're putting on it. The resistive component of the tube is a very high impedance. That's the good news. The bad news is that every reasonable tube you and I are likely to use that can handle 500 watts, 1,000 watts, 1,500 watts, that tube, the plate circuit of that tube, always has a significant amount of capacitance. A pair of 4CX250Bs, 4.5 picofarad per plate, that's 9 picofarad, not counting strays. Your 3-whatever tube is going to also have some significant number of picofarads of plate capacitance. You look at your tube manual, you'll find out what that is right away. Therefore, when you're doing the design of that plate circuit, if, for instance, you're grounding one end of the strip line resonator, at the other end, you're hanging the plate circuit of the power output tube, isolated with a coupling capacitor, and the coupling capacitor, the right way to do that is the coupling capacitor should be one of the flat plates that's parallel to the strip line right where the tube is. You know, when the strip line and the plate coupling capacitor, the B-plus bypass that the strip line resonator runs at ground at one end, and literally grounded B-plus wise, and then you got this strip line coupling capacitor at the end where the finger stock of the tube, if it was a 4CX250B tube, or the plate of your particular tube is going to hang. That capacitance, when put on the end of the quarter-wave-long resonator, will significantly shorten it. If, for instance, your particular plate circuit strip line was designed for, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, 100 ohms of characteristic impedance, a possible number you might use, and if the capacitive reactance of your tube at the higher frequency presented 100 ohms of capacitive reactance, it's quite possible that the shortening of the resonator, the strip line, in order to bring it back into resonance, because of that plate capacitance you're hanging at the far end, it might bring it down to something closer to an eighth wave. So a person looking at that, studying it, how many inches long and what frequency you're operating at, would say, gee, that plate circuit is an eighth wavelength long. Is there something magic about eighth wavelength? The answer is no. Let me stand by. Let me drop you for a second. The presence of all of the capacitance of the tube is what caused the resonator to be made physically shorter, so that with that capacitance as the loading at the far end, with or without another flapper tuning capacitor, which is the plate of the circuit, plate of the tube itself, is going to significantly shorten the plate resonator circuit. Now, there's a relatively simple formula which tells you, let's get it the other way around. If I'm now looking at the plate of the tube as a lumped capacitor, and that's what it really is, it's a fixed lumped capacitor, and I want to resonate it, I'm going to figure out how much capacitor reactance it has. Maybe the answer is 100 ohms. I'm now going to say, how much inductance must I put across that capacitor to bring it to resonance? The answer is it's 100 ohms of inductive reactance. How do you make 100 ohms of inductive reactance? By making a strip line resonator, short-circuited at one end, less than a quarter wave long. As you go smaller and smaller than a quarter wavelength long, the inductive reactance that the strip line presents to the tube gets lower and lower. And if you can force the inductive reactance of the strip line resonator, in my example, to be 100 ohms of inductive reactance, at the same time that the plate of your tube has a capacitor reactance of 100 ohms, voila, you've got resonance. Now, when it comes to coupling that allows the plate circuit to resonate. You're driving the grid of the tube, the plate circuit is going on and off with its current conduction, it's driving a signal into that plate resonator, the strip line. Because it's in resonance, you build up a nice big voltage, very similar to pushing your child on a swing. If you push the child at the right periods of time in resonance with the swing's natural resonant frequency, in a very short period of time, you build up a very big swinging signal on your plate circuit, or a very big swinging of your child on the child swing. Let me drop. Once you've got the plate circuit resonated, you're halfway home. Now, the plate circuit is building up some nice big chunks of RF energy, and you've got to couple it to the output. Because a schematic diagram of a plate circuit made out of a coil, like you might use on 6 meters. 6 meters, you're going to have some number of turns of a small diameter copper tubing as the plate circuit inductor that does the resonating of the plate circuit. And because, as a schematic diagram, that's the primary of a transformer, the link coupling going to the output connector, to your coaxial cable, your feed line, is another link. It looks like the secondary of a transformer. And everybody understands a transformer has a schematic diagram. And for that reason, link coupling is used on 90-some-odd% of the VHF transmitters. We're falling into a trap when you do that. That link, when you put it near the plate resonator, the link picks up some of that energy as a secondary of a transformer. The size of the link, the location of the link, how close it is to the plate resonator, determines the coupling coefficient. The link itself, you usually resonate it by putting another series capacitor in series with the link. And there's where the problem lies. Let me drop. And this is reasonably explained, not really deeply explained, but reasonably explained in the original article on the 432 megacycle strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier. April and May 1972, it's an oldie but goodie, and there's thousands of those transmitters in use today, even though it's a 30-some-odd-year-old transmitter, but it's almost a 40-year-old transmitter. And it gives you an explanation of what is the advantage of capacitive coupling over link coupling. In the case of link coupling, you've got that series capacitor in series with the link, which you resonate in order to adjust the output loading. But there's a big catch. Somewhere in the middle of the tuning of that series variable capacitor, it resonates with your link. And at the resonance is where you get the maximum coupling. As you make that capacitor larger or smaller, the link is no longer in resonance. If it's no longer in resonance, the coupling coefficient goes down. So you get this peculiar tuning characteristic with link coupling. You're turning the control between zero and maximum. Somewhere in the middle, you get the maximum coupling. You go beyond that, and the coupling goes back down again. You'd like to have, from classic ham radio pie tank circuits, you'd like to have a tuning control and a loading control. And you'd like the loading control to always work in one direction. You know, as you turn it more and more clockwise, less and less capacitance on the C2 capacitor, you got more and more output loading. But in the case of link coupling, you get this peculiar characteristic where it starts folding back on itself, so to speak. As such, there's a significant number of VHF transmitters out there which are not being properly loaded. The guy operated that loading capacitor on the link until he got maximum output power. He assumed, aha, that's the maximum, that's all I can get. He doesn't realize he's running with very light loading because that's the only place where that link resonates, and for that particular size of loop and distance to the loop, to the resonator of the plate.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's where he gets a kind of maximum output, but it's not the real maximum. If you're smart enough to use capacitive coupling instead, series coupling capacitor, simply between the semiconductor of your output coaxial cable and somewhere along the plate resonator. And with rare exception, there is no magic place. You can put that capacitive coupling almost anywhere from an eighth of the way above ground all the way up to the plate circuit itself. Make that coupling capacitor the right value, you'll get the right loading. There's some interaction between loading and tuning, but the nice thing about capacitive loading is that it's thoroughly linear. More capacitance on the capacitive loading circuit always gives you more loading. It doesn't have this fold-back characteristic. On top of that, there are guys who think that link coupling is so great because it's a real output resonator, therefore it's rejecting harmonics, whereas the capacitive coupling, they think they're not rejecting harmonics. You study what's happening with that link resonator, it has a Q of about 1, or maybe 2, it's got a very low Q, it doesn't really reject higher frequencies like you think it does. The difference is a couple of dB of difference in second harmonic when you're looking for 50 or 60 dB of rejection of second harmonic in order to meet FCC specs. So the link coupling is not going to save you. It's going to give you trouble. So when you look at the whole big picture and when you read that article on April and May 1972 QST, which is in the archives, let me drop. It gives you a graph and an explanation for what is the advantage of capacitive coupling. And once you get familiar with it, you'll say, gee, why haven't we always done it that way? Why do we keep doing it the other way? So you've got a little bit of the information now about a quarter wave resonator. You start off with quarter wave, but it becomes a lot smaller than quarter wave because of the capacitance of the tube. That's if you want the resonator to run in a grounded manner. where it really is quarter wave long electronically and grounded at one end, literally grounded to the chassis. And if you can make a good enough ground. Well, when you get up to 432 with some of these big tubes, the quarter wave resonator becomes so short there's no line left at all. Therefore, you're way ahead of the game to make a half wave resonator. The good news about a half wave resonator is that it becomes very easy to tune. The bad news is it's a little bit longer. And the other piece of bad news is, in most cases, you're going to run it with B-plus on the resonator itself. But you don't have to. There's ways you can get around that one also. So, for a bunch of reasons, the plate circuit on the parallel kilowatt is a half wave long. And whatever you did between the grounded section and the tube, you just do it again on the other side. And depending how big your flapper capacitor is on a half wave resonator, you're resonating the right-hand side also. In both cases, the amount of inductor reactance created by that chunk of the plate circuit, strip line, is resonating with whatever that capacitor is you're using, whether it's the flapper tuning capacitor on the right side of a half-wave resonator, or it's the anode of the vacuum tube on the left side. That's a thumbnail sketch. You've got about 10% of the information you'd like to have, but it's the beginning of the process. And once you start studying these plate circuits and realize the right way to build them, Rich, you're going to become an advocate. You're going to be preaching this stuff on the air, and you're going to be telling these guys, why haven't you been doing it this way a long time ago? N2, Echo Oscar, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, then, so you cleared up a lot of information for me. In other words, what you're really saying is the strip line L is in parallel with the plate capacitance of the tube C, where X of L has to equal X of C to make resonance. Yeah, the plate capacitance of the 3CX800 is about 25 picofarads. So what I have to do is figure 1 over 2 pi, what is it, 2 pi, X of C equals 1 over 2 pi FC, I believe. And figure the inductive, the capacitive reactance at 2 meters of that tube, and we want to make L the same equal and opposite value as far as vectors go, and it'll be resonant. Am I correct, Dick?
Give that man a cigar. You got it, fella. You sucked it all up. 1 over 2 pi FC. Plug in the frequency in 2 pi and your capacitance in farads, and your answer is going to come out in ohms if you put in the frequency in hertz, or you can put in the frequency in gigahertz and picofarads. There's various ways you can do it, but you've got the right formula. That tells you the capacitive reactance. Now your strip line is going to present the exact same amount of inductive reactance in ohms. And now in the case of strip line, depending on how wide you make the strip line, and how far is the spacing between the upper ground plane and the lower ground plane? Go to the right curve and the reference data for radio engineers and a whole lot of other books. Once you know the dimensions of your strip line and the ground plane spacing, that tells you the Z0. Very similar to what happens with coax cable. You tell me the outside diameter and the inside diameter of a coax cable, and you go to the right formula. I think it's 176. Log of A over B, I think it is. But anyhow, I think it's the formula. But anyhow, there's a simple formula where you know the diameter of the inner and outer diameter of the coax cable. It tells you the impedance. And if you were using a coax cable as the resonator, and you could, but I don't recommend it, you now want to know what length of coax cable is going to give you that number of ohms of inductive reactance. Well, in the case of strip line, you know the dimensions, you're going to know the characteristic impedance. Characteristic impedance of your strip line is usually called Z0, Z sub 0. Now, how do you figure out what length of line is going to give you that number of ohms? And here's the formula. X sub L equals Z0 tan theta. Simple as that. Let's assume now that my Z0 happened to be... Let's assume that my Z0 happened to be 100 ohms. Let's assume that my capacitive reactance happens to be 100 ohms. And so now I want the X sub L to be 100 ohms. So I plug everything into the formula that I know. 100 ohms on the left, that's the X sub L, equals Z0 tan theta. Z0 is 100 ohms times tan theta. Well, for that to balance, I want tan theta to equal 1. when does the tangent equal 1? When theta equals 45 degrees. What is 45 degrees? 45 degrees is an eighth of a wavelength. Ain't that funny? Degrees, 360 degrees is a full wavelength, 180 degrees is half wavelength, 90 degrees is a quarter wavelength, 45 degrees is an eighth of a wavelength. You plug it into that formula, now you know exactly how long to make the strip line of your known dimensions of width and height in order to resonate your particular capacitance of the tube. I think you see what's going on. And that's going to get you well inside the ballpark. Because there's always some stray... capacitance of your particular mounting hardware and the other things that are nearby and the RF choke and your bypass capacitor and whatever else. And by the time you put the tube in the socket alongside of the edge of the chassis to some other stray capacitance, it's going to be a little bit off. But you're going to be so close that with your grid dip meter you can easily find it, or your swept frequency oscillator you equally find it, or moving your tuning capacitor up and down you'll easily find it. You're going to be so close to the center of the ballpark that with a little bit of tweaking, you're going to be right at home plate. I think you see the process there, Rich. And it's going to be a lot of fun, and you're going to have a lot of bragging out of this one once you do it. N2 Echo Oscar, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick,
N2EO,
yeah, well, you know, this is going to be a very good project because I found ripping apart these Heathkit SB220s and building them up for other bands. They make an excellent platform because you got a power supply, you got a metering circuit, you got all the control circuitry. What I plan to do is take out the 3500 low band amplifier section. I'm going to put a sub chassis in there and sort of copy the mechanical construction of your RIW. Kilowatts for 432 to a point. I'm not using a pair of tubes. I'm using a single 3CX800 triode, which is sort of a baby 8877. It'll run about 2300 volts on the plate, 2500 volts on the plate under load, and they say about 750 to 800 watts out TEP. Good 350 megs, that tube. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, that 3CX800, I think it's the one you're going to use. That's a real good moose of a tube. You move enough air through it, and it'll tolerate a short circuit, open circuit, mistune. It'll tolerate a whole lot of abuse, as long as you don't exceed the control grid maximum current, which would be control grid dissipation on that triode. And there's a tetrode equivalent of it, 4CX800, which you ought to consider. And a little bit pricey, but a really rugged tube. You give it the right filament voltage, you give it enough air, and that tube will quite possibly outlive you and I, if you know what I mean, Rich. Real good bottle. The only other thing you're going to discover is that once you calculate the length of the strip line at 2 meters for that particular tube, I predict that the physical length is going to be longer than the amount of dimensions you got inside of that box, and you'd like to locate everything inside the box. That's going to push you into one of two other decisions. Let me drop. And that is either you're going to go back to a piece of coiled up copper tubing as the plate resonator. That's one possible approach, which as long as the pop copper tubing is large enough in diameter so the current density on it is low enough, it can run at 100% efficiency. Lots of people think they're going to get super high efficiency out of a strip line circuit compared to a piece of copper tubing as a coil. Well, be careful. If the copper tubing as a coil is dissipating 3 watts in actual operation because that's how hot it's getting, and if you've done a good job, that may be what it really does, and the strip line is only going to dissipate 1 watt, yeah, you're getting a 3-to-1 improvement. But 1 watt versus 3 watts of dissipation when you're running 800 watts of output, it's obvious that that difference in efficiency is very small. So in that particular case, should you keep fighting for a strip line just because you've fallen in love with strip line? By the time you get up to 432 and you want high efficiency and you don't want to do it with a, you can't do it with a copper piece of tubing. On 432, you're forced into something like strip line. But on 2 meters, you've got a couple of choices. If you really want to insist on using the strip line because you haven't got enough big enough box, your other approach then is to fold the strip line. There's nothing magic about the strip line being straight out, just like there's nothing magic about the dipole antenna always being completely flat with the ground and horizontal and polarization and fed in the exact center. A dipole can be zigzagged in all kinds of ways. Well, the plate resonator can be zigzagged in all kinds of ways. So there's lots of ways of taking the strip line and folding it. Now, are you going to fold it horizontally, which is the hard fold, or are you going to fold it vertically, the easy fold? Your choice. But there's various ways you can fold the strip line so that it starts off the plate circuit, which is on the south side of the box. It goes toward the north side of the box, makes a right angle bend by diving down and coming around back with a 180 degree bend, and then starts coming back to the south side of the box again with another piece of grounding plate in there, so that it becomes not only tri-plate strip line, but pieces of two tri-plate strip lines stacked on top of each other with a fold. That's the so-called easy fold. The hard fold is where it would go from the tube at the south side of the box, it would go toward the north side of the box, the strip line. It would make a left-hand turn toward the west, and then proceed to the west for a short distance, then make another left-hand turn and proceed toward the south, and then that's folding the hard way. You can make an easy fold or a hard fold with the strip line. There's a zillion ways you can fold the strip line. And keep the efficiency when you do it. Complicated looking structure out of pieces of sheet metal cut up with your tin snips and drilled with your hand drill. You'd be amazed how easy you can do that. That whole parallel kilowatt amplifier. Let me drop.
Jason CPZ with a comment.
Now recognize that whole strip line amplifier for 432. Back in the days when people were thinking that 432 circuits had to be a cavity resonator, is what they believed. And therefore it was built with lathe work. And that whole amplifier with strip line made out of flat pieces of copper clad and a bud box was built with hand tools in the second bedroom of the apartment where I was living at the time. So when it comes to construction, strip line's got a lot going for it. So let's see if Hal's got another suggestion as to a better way of folding the plate resonator. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Well, I was just thinking of a cavity resonator, which wouldn't take up that much space. And that may involve a little machining, but the Q would be very good. You match the impedances, drive points of the cavity, and you have a very efficient output circuit at UHF.
Hal, did you hear the beginning of this conversation 10 minutes ago, or did you just join us? Go ahead.
I just joined.
You're going to have to play it back when it's recorded on the website. You missed the beginning, very important information. I gave a whole lot of reasons why what you just said, everyone believes. I strongly disbelieve it, and I gave the reasons why. So you've expressed another opinion. Everyone thinks cavity resonators are higher in efficiency than strip line. Dead wrong. Everyone thinks that there's a magic 50-ohm point on the cavity resonator where you do the output connecting. Dead wrong. As long as you're willing to use capacitive coupling for the output, you can do it in a zillion different places along the resonator. You can't get higher in efficiency than strip line properly deployed. You can do it with hand tools. You don't need lathe work. Everyone thinks that a round cavity resonator has higher Q. Dead wrong. Good common sense. Everyone believed it. For a zillion years, no one went and checked it. I did. I went and actually made measurements. That's another whole story. So Hal has expressed a very popular opinion. As you can tell, I strongly disagree with what an awful lot of people believe to be true, and they just heard it as an old wives' tale from zillions of other hands, and therefore everyone just propagated that opinion downrange. No one bothered checking on it. Very similar with everybody assuming that a SO239 UHF connector has got half a dB of loss at 432, and if you replace it with type N connectors, it's going to pick up half a dB of improvement. Absolutely not true. Everyone believes it. So it's just one of those tales, as you can see, Hal. I know you and I are going to have some further discussions on this one. Back to you for a final, because I got to move on now, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I want to thank you very much for the time, And we'll visit this again, because this is a project that I'm going to start probably in the early fall once I get a few of my other projects out of the way. So let me turn it back to you and pick up the next customer, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet Weimar. Thank you. And to you.
Yeah, there are very few things that we can really shine as amateur radio operators. Building antennas, without a doubt, we can shine. Building high-power amplifiers, if you're a little bit crafty with hand tools and you understand the theory of operation, we can really shine in that area. To buy an amplifier that'll do what you're about to build would cost you a whole lot of money. To build it, have the fun of doing it, understand it, and get the operation just right, go on the air and brag about it, it's a win-win situation. When it comes to an 80 through 10 meter single sideband rig, nobody in his right mind is going to hand build one of those today. You take 1 or 2 weeks of your salary and you go out and buy the best that Southeast Asia or Tentec has got to offer, if you know what I mean. You don't want to build one of those. It's got 1,000 transistor equivalent functions inside there, and you wouldn't live long enough to do that. So you have to choose your places where you're going to apply your resources, your time and money. And so final amplifiers and antennas are some of the really good places. Joe, W-H-2-R-Y-Y, what's going on the South Shore of Long Island these days? K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. How you doing? W-H-2-R-Y-Y. I have a comment and a question. The comment I have, I've noticed RF energy being propagated in the frequency space of 746.5 to 755.5. Haven't noticed it recently. Like in the past couple months, just seemed something I was looking at, it just seemed to pop up out of nowhere. I know this is a band, I think, for possibly cellular, and that'll be the question that I'm actually going to ask you about the type of modulation you use. But the comment would be, for some people who have over-the-air reception television, this might start posing a problem for the tuners possibly being overloaded by seeing these carriers or whatever they are just pop up and all of a sudden, you know, become like right in your neighborhood where it wasn't there before. Okay, back to you.
Yeah, 746 is approximately channel 60 in that vicinity of the old-fashioned television, UHF television. And I think channel 59 is now the highest channel that's used for broadcast television.
51.
Say that again.
51.
Wow. That makes some sense. I should have realized that. The new LTE frequency region, by way of the conversion from analog television to digital television, and a whole lot of UHF frequencies were freed up, now what's going to be the handheld services, my word for it, LTE frequency range, Wi-Fi, call it what you like, third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation cell phone. These newer handheld devices with RF connection between you and the rest of the world are starting at numbers around 700 megacycles and going up from there with very little interruption for a couple of other services. If you go to the latest FCC chart, if you go to the FCC.gov, there's a way you can get an extremely compact frequency chart where every megacycle from DC to light, so to speak, they tell you what the current allocation is. And if you've got a big enough color printer, and you can expand portions of that chart and make a color print of it, it's a pretty looking thing. It tells you exactly who is the primary, the secondary, and whatever frequency allocated service for each one of those frequency regions. That will give you a clue. But now that these above 700 meg frequencies are eventually going to all be operating in your handheld device, it doesn't surprise me at all that various services are starting to add these extra frequencies to extra frequencies to their cell sites, add these extra frequencies to the handheld devices, and it's just a matter of time between all of those frequencies going to be filled up because there's a huge customer base here. I mean, the total number of cell phones, I'm hearing a tone in the background. Sometimes my rig does that. You heard me hitting my rig with a fist. And it didn't stop. The services that are out there today are going to be continuously expanding. I think there's like 315 million cell phones in use in the United States alone. That's the total number of cell sites cell phones in use in the world is some huge number. If I had to make a guess, I guess it's getting close to a billion cell phones. And we all are demanding more and more bandwidth. We want faster service. We want to see live movies, downloading movies, and whatever. So the only way that that can be handled is more and more bandwidth has to be allocated. And slowly that's happening. So you're going to see lots and lots of frequencies slowly filling in my opinion. I've been running a series of experiments. Let me drop. I personally have been running a series of experiments on an outdoor test facility in the 900 megacycle frequency region with reference to RFID products, and we're discovering that if the RFID reader doesn't have some real good filtering, the adjacent frequencies above and below 900 megs can give you quite a bit of grief. And operating in what I thought was a rural area of Suffolk County, turns out that you start studying the charts as to who's allocated, what frequencies they're allowed to transmit, where is the tower located, how close is it to major organizations like Stony Brook or Suffolk Community College or whatever. You'd be amazed how many things are emitting lots of signals for communication, data transfer, video for security reasons, for surveillance, security, and so on. So you're going to find lots of things filling up. By way of your scanner and your spectrum analyzer that you've got as your part of your service monitor, you'll eventually see what kind of modulation is being used. That's going to give you a hint. But so, if I understood you correctly, 746.5 to 745 or something like that, I presume that's megacycles, are where you're seeing these signals. Is that true, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y? H-U-R-Y-W?
Y-O. Yeah, I heard somebody else get in there. I'm not sure if they're coming in through Echolink or whatever. 746.5 is the edge, the lower edge of the frequency. All right, see, there's data emission coming out of the top end of 755.5. So it's about 10.
9 or 10 megs or so. That's wider than a television channel, but it is the kind of width in which a picture ascending security system could be allocated. Eventually, it's going to be cell site-like functions, fourth generation, LTE, and so on. You're going to hear all kinds of abbreviations. I think it was Bernie that assigned in K2IO. If so, Bernie, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, in the net. Just FYI, I just put a copy of that chart into the Dropbox for tonight's show. So anybody that's interested in it, just send me an email. Look up my call sign on QRZ and drop me an email. I'll add you to the Dropbox and you can get a copy of that FCC chart. And Dick, you're right. That is an incredible looking piece of, I'm going to call it artwork. You could spend hours just studying where all those things are packed in.
Well done, Bernie. Bernie is the place where the latest information that Wes and I and John and others and Glenn, when we start digging deep into stuff, 90-some-odd% of the time, that material will be available to you by way of Bernie's website. And one of the places where you get a hold of Bernie is by going to, I think it's www.bernie@huntfamily.com, if I understand correctly. I think it's bernie@huntfamily.com, and I think he's going to give you a way of getting this chart. This chart that I'm talking about, the FCC chart, it is a beautiful piece of artwork. It's got about 6 or 7 colors to it. It's dense as all hell. In other words, when you finally see a printout, if you had your druthers, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to zero in on a small section of that. You're going to find a way of copying just that section onto your printer. But if you had the ability to print the whole darn thing, you'd like to print it 3 feet wide and 2 feet high, and even then you'd be walking up to it with a magnifying glass to see the fine details. Lots and lots of data there. Beautiful looking piece of artwork. Some people, and I'm one of them, have taken a picture of that on a color printer and pasted it on your wall. It's just an attractive looking chart proving to the rest of the world when they come into your cubicle at wherever you work that, hey, you're a high-tech person because you've got this beautiful piece of art, which is not art. It's very specific engineering. The latest and the greatest of the frequency allocation chart of the Federal Communications Commission. Who was it that wanted to say something? K2RIW? Okay, so Bernie is offering that chart to you. that's going to give you some hints, as I see it, Joe. Not going to give you the whole answer, because that whole frequency region above 700 megs up to 902 megacycles, that lower frequency region below the license-free band. The license-free band is 902 to 928. Both ham radio is a secondary user. And by the way, the word secondary user is very nicely being defined in the latest issue of QST Magazine. When you get your June issue of QST Magazine, I think of the introductory offer article by the chief executive officer of ARRL. He explains what secondary user is. Also, when you read the latest issue of QST, you're going to find out that the magic band, 6 meters, we're about to hit the most fun portion of that. Let me drop. Starting in the middle of May, going to roughly the middle of June, is the peak of the sporadic E and trans-equatorial and field-align anomaly and everything else. All these crazy propagations of 6 meters. 6 meters is called the magic band because it has almost every kind of propagation you can imagine. Sporadic E and meteor scatter and moon bounce and tropo and all these other ones that I mentioned. Aurora and so on. Almost every kind of propagation you can think of at some time of the day or night is going to occur on 6 meters. The latest issue of QST Magazine on page 88 has a 6 meter summer e-skip season, two pages of that. And then starting on page 90 is a beautiful article in the World Above 50 Megs, which gives you a whole lot of 6 meter information. And the guys have recently been talking from the United States to way down deep into South America on 6 meters. So if you have any interest in long-range VHF propagation, and you've got 6 meter capability, you want to see the June issue of QST Magazine. Lots of good stuff there. Anything further we should discuss tonight, Joe? W2RYY for a final, K2RYW.
I was going to ask you, I don't have much time, because about a little less than 9 o'clock, I got to get off the radio, about 10 minutes or so, or a little less. I have to take a look at this thing with the spectrum analyzer. I'm just trying to analyze what kind of data modulation I was seeing. I was happening to see this thing produce peaks of data, every 45 kilohertz going from, 746.530, and every 45 kilohertz I see a peak of data. Now, what I noticed in a wide scan was I would see the data change in amplitude, like chunks of amplitude, or chunks of data would be changing in amplitude about plus 15 dB, higher than the average signal I saw. This stuff didn't look like CDMA type of a transmission where it could continuously flatten across the whole, width, or like you'd see with a TV type of transmission with some of the current, cellular CDMA type of transmission. This looked a little different. And when I turned the service monitor into AM mode for DMOD, I was getting about a 1 kilohertz type of pitch coming out of this information across the entire spread. Any idea what you think this is?
Probably not, Joe. As we discussed with a question you asked last week or the week before, modern-day communication systems are starting to use very elaborate modulation techniques. Are they angular modulated or amplitude modulated? The answer is yes. Are they digital? Usually yes. You start combining amplitude and angular, and you start doing things like 16 QAM, quad amplitude modulation. As you start using these very elaborate modulation techniques, you're now transmitting a large number of bits of information per symbol that's transmitted. Therefore, the bandwidth that's allocated, in your case about 9 megacycles of bandwidth, if they're using the right kind of modulation, they could put many times 9 million bits per second of data through that channel. And depending on what bandwidth you use to analyze it on your spectrum analyzer, you'll get various performances as you go to wideband, narrowband, as you look at the various frequency components simultaneously, and so on. So elaborate modulation techniques, whether it be the time domain, TDMA, time domain, multiple access, frequency domain, multiple access, and so on, code division, 8VSB is the one that's used for television. There's some very elaborate modulation techniques being used these days. The chips can easily generate them. the vector modulator on the transmitter allows you to independently, with high fidelity, control the instantaneous amplitude and the instantaneous phase of what comes through the transmitter, as long as the whole transmitter chain, is sufficiently linear, it will reproduce that signal that comes out of your vector modulator. The vector modulator used to be a very elaborate circuit that we amateur radios built, radio operators built back in the days when we were using the phasing technique or the filtering technique for single sideband generation. Nowadays, a very small, inexpensive integrated circuit chip does that all for you automatically with very high fidelity. So you can use these vector modulators, vector demodulator chips, and so now it's a matter of buying the right chips, putting them together as a step and repeat block thing that eventually becomes a very compact, high-performance receiver or transmitter. And so small packages these days can do some very elaborate things, and analyzing them is not easy. And as you listen to them with various bandwidths, you'll hear various tones in audio. You'll see various rates on the spectrum analyzer or the oscilloscope, whatever you're using. I didn't say it's easy, but you'll eventually find out what it is. That frequency chart that Bernie is now making available to us is going to help. Okay, let's see now. Those two people signed in. Who was the third person? I know that Wes signed in. He's got some very nice questions.
Hi. Oh.
Now go right ahead there, Bernie.
Just added one more link to the Dropbox. The government printing office offers a hard copy version of that that's 30 inches tall and 40 inches wide, and it appears to be about $10 or $12, so that could be a very cool poster for somebody to have in their ham shack.
Well done, Bernie. As I said, I've got a piece of that on my wall in my office where my salt mine is, and various people come in and say, what is that beautiful thing? And they walk up close to it and realize it's not just a piece of artwork. It's got very specific, hardcore, frequency, here we go, Friendly Candy Company, Federal Communications Commission, latest data, if you know what I mean, in that particular frequency region. And so it's a beautiful chart, $12, properly framed. That makes a really pretty thing, in my opinion. Some of us have access to very wide format, color, Xerox printers at your place of work. That combined with the right computer program that drives that printer, with a download from the FCC, you can get it for quasi-free. However, very few of us have got access to that kind of a machine. The other approach would be to tile it. In other words, with the proper kind of setting up of the printing commands, you can print the upper left-hand corner, the lower left-hand corner, and so on, and then tape it all together. I've seen people do that. And if you do a careful cutting and taping job, it can look pretty good. Or you just simply follow Bernie's suggestion and pay the $12. And if it's a well-printed thing, and if I think it's going to be 40-some-odd inches wide and 30-some inches high, that's worth it. I've paid a lot more for great big format hard copy printers, pictures in the past, so I think that's a good deal. Enjoy that one. Alrighty, who was the third person who signed in? I know Wes is going to sign in with some further questions later on downrange. Maybe we'll... Let me make sure I didn't miss anybody besides Wes up till now. Give me a call letters if I did. K2RIW.
Dick, I have a quick follow-up question, if it's okay. It's who we are.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, you can give me a yes or no on this, and we can take this up next week, but... When you mentioned capacitive coupling versus link coupling, you got me thinking. My Collins 62S1, 6 and 2 meter transmitter, I always felt it did not give enough loading on 6 meters. It uses a coil, a tap coil on 6 and 2. You can answer me yes or no. Is it possible to capacitively couple that rather than a link couple it? The way Collins did it, and we can discuss it next week if it can be done.
On any transmitter starting off at roughly 100 kilohertz, up to and including 10 gigahertz, if you're smart enough, you can almost always use capacitive coupling in the final stage between the final resonator of that final amplifying device and your output coax connector you can always use. Link coupling, as a schematic diagram, looks very friendly. It looks like a primary and secondary of a transformer when you see a schematic on paper. When you deploy it in the real world, if you're not smart enough, it can be a minefield. There's a number of hidden traps in various kinds of link coupling and tapped coil coupling where you may not get proper loading. And one of the quickest ways to detect whether or not you've got proper loading, if it's a tetrode tube in the final stage, is to measure screen grid current at resonance. If the screen grid current at resonance is a high number, positive screen grid current, then your loading is very light. If your screen grid current is zero or near negative values, your loading is very heavy. And in the case of a 4CX250B, and it's probably true of a 4CX800, any of the tetrode-like tubes, in many cases, best loading, maximum power output, and sometimes best linearity occurs when you have the amount of loading so that the screen grid current is very close to zero or just a couple of milliamps positive when you're at resonance. You've got to be careful now that it's at resonance because you knock the plate circuit out of resonance, and in some cases the screen current will climb sky high. No, very low. It'll go very low and go negative because it looks like heavy loading. You're getting very little plate circuit swing, if you know what I mean. So once you understand what that means, with a tetrode, it's easy to tell whether or not you've got enough loading. With a triode, it's much, much more difficult. And so, the fact...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
One of the techniques you can use possibly for detecting whether or not the loading is possible or proper on a triode, high-power triode, is as you rock the tuning control above and below resonance. The rate at which the plate circuit current rises, that gives you a strong clue, but now you could have more specific information as to how fast you're changing the picofarads on that plate variable capacitor tuning control. As I said, the data is there. It's going to take a little bit more finesse to figure out what's going on. If you had a screen grid, light becomes easy. With a triode, proper loading is difficult to determine. Probably the best way to determine it is that if you're sure that enough drive is occurring at the input end, and if it's grounded grid, as triodes usually are you driving that cathode hard enough? You can get a clue about that, because as you start driving the cathode too hard, the control grid current starts climbing. That's a clue. The control grid current curve versus plate circuit loading and tuning, there's a couple of more clues there, but it takes a lot of experience to know what you're looking at and how to interpret it. So without a doubt, a possibility exists that you're not hitting enough loading, assuming you've got enough drive. There's ways you can confirm enough drive. I think you have an RF voltmeter. By way of your RF voltmeter with the right kind of a capacitor tap circuit, a sniffer circuit, you can find out whether or not you're putting the right number of RF volts on that cathode of that grounded grid amplifier. Back to you, Rich, N2EO, K2LIW.
82BHY with a late check-in.
Jim recognized, and Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, we'll say good evening to James. Dick, the 62S1 uses a 4X250, grid-driven, grounded cathode, tap coil, switchable between 6 and 2 meters. And oddly enough, I guess, you would think it would be the reverse. I'm getting more output on 2 than I am on 6. And I strongly suspect that I'm not loading heavily enough on 6 meters. Like I said, I don't want to take up any more net time, but if you can maybe give me a critique next week on how to modify that link coupled output to give me capacitive coupled output that would be switchable on 6 and 2, it would be much appreciated. Maybe you're familiar with the column 62S1. I don't know if you are. N2EO.
I haven't personally operated with a 62S1 or really seen one on the inside, but I've heard enough stories, talked to enough people who have used them, and now that you've got tetrode tubes in there, when you look at the screen grid current on 2 meters and the power output on 2 meters, and then you go down to 6 meters and look at that screen grid current, power output, assuming the input grid is being driven hard enough, there's ways you